Welcome to Management Matters, an award-winning National Academy of Public Administration podcast where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Girton, president of the Academy. The Academy has partnered with GovExec TV to produce an 8-part series on artificial intelligence in the public sector. This episode focuses on AI technologies and public education and features panelists Teresa Pardo, Brenda Bannon, Jerry Meckling, and Alan Shark. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Hello and welcome to Artificial Intelligence in the Public Sector, AI Technologies, and Public Education, the 8th and final episode in our 8-episode season with the National Academy of Public Administration. I'm your host, George Jackson, with GovExec TV. Consider this. 40 years ago, engineering school faculty were expressing concern over new standards that would replace the trusted slide rule with new and sophisticated handheld calculators. In some schools, those calculators were even banned during exams or entrance tests. Today, that controversy seems almost quaint, considering the advent of generative AI. The implications are far more complicated, and the consequences could be far more serious. Here for episode 8, Jerry Meckling. He's former fellow at the Institute of Politics and a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Sir, thanks for being here.
Delighted.
Brenda Bannon, professor in the College of Education and Human Development at George Mason University. She's also founding member of the Center for Advancing Human-Machine Partnership. Welcome.
Thank you.
Teresa Pardo, Associate Vice President for Research and Economic Development at the University at Albany, State University of New York, SUNY for short. She's also Senior Fellow at the Center for Technology and Government there. Ma'am, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And here again, my esteemed co-host, Alan Shark, Associate Professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He's also Executive Director for the Public Technology Institute. Welcome back.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
So, Alan, I'm going to ask you and then Brenda to kick us off. The two of you co-authored a report that serves as the inspiration for this topic. Give us some context, and then I'd love for you to follow on there, ma'am.
Well, what we wrote was really an exploratory paper that looked at all the possibilities of AI in education, and not just higher education, but all of education. And we came up with a number of things that people could consider. And so to us, we were learning as we went through this process, because we believe that AI in education is probably one of the most fundamental shifts that have occurred in at least 100 years. Perhaps even, I can't think of anything else more profound that affects more disciplines. In fact, the whole field of education and the way we teach, the way we do research, and the way we learn.
It's really challenging our practice in many ways. It's forcing us as educators to rethink our instructional strategies, to rethink our assessments, to kind of be able to utilize the strengths of these tools to maximize student learning. And so in that, there's a reconsideration of how we learn. And there's also potential of these tools to impact educational research. There are many different ways to capture behaviors and interactions with some of these tools that we've never had before in real time at the moment that can perhaps have us learn a lot more about learning and teaching.
Is it also, Teresa, changing the way that people think about the way educational institutions themselves are built? And I'm thinking about cross-pollination of degrees, you know, different houses like humanities and science and technology being bridged in ways that weren't bridged before.
Absolutely. I think it's maybe sort of a high point in what we've seen in recent memory about the creation of interdisciplinarity, right? And the institutionalization, if you will, of interdisciplinarity, of our recognition that most societal challenges that we're facing today cannot be solved, and in many cases, maybe most cases, can't be understood from a single discipline, let alone resolved. So I think that the introduction of AI as a cross-cutting technology is really important to our ability to think about how do we leverage the existing capabilities of our research universities, and potentially how do we reorganize those institutions so that we can, in fact, fully maximize the potential of the primary disciplines, but how we bring those primary disciplines together with technology, in this case AI, but certainly other technologies as well, to address these societal challenges. And I do think that educating the workforce is in fact one of our challenges, right? We have to have a better understanding of how best to do this. And I think AI itself could potentially help inform our decisions about how best to organize our institutions so that we can leverage technology in new ways and leverage the interdisciplinarity that's so critical for these complex social problems.
Jerry, I promise I won't ask you to be Mr. Doom and Gloom for this entire conversation, but I would like you to tee up the portion where we talk about some of the risks that these education institutions are facing or trying to address. Like, what are the challenges here?
A classic one that a lot of educators get concerned about is, when is it plagiarism or not? When is the evidence presented real evidence, or when is it disinformation or misinformation and a lie? And so we're focused on that. But that's not the only thing we need to be focused on. If there is a mistake we could be making, it may be the things we aren't thinking as much about. And so I would like to keep a balance between what we're paying attention to and what we aren't. And I think educational move to different people involve different institutions broadly beyond what we now have. Let me just give one example. I was intrigued by the Khan Academy going out with Khanamigo to, again, reach more people in a conversational mode without having to have a live tutor there. So you could have more people having to think because they get prompted and responded to in their questions. Those kind of things we need to think about. They're on the table now, and I'm not sure we're thinking about them enough.
Why is that difference, Alan, between disinformation and misinformation important?
Well, I think one is deliberate. The other is carelessness. I think they're both really important, but I worry more about the disinformation where somebody intentionally is derailing the thought process or coming up with information that makes no sense, that could turn people against a government institution and cause great harm, or to a discipline. Misinformation is somebody merely taking something and just passing it on as fact, when in fact it isn't. So they sound alike, but their origins are different, and they need to be policed and thought of very differently in terms of strategies.
Brenda, draw us back to the student in this conversation. I mean, Alan Sharks, one of his key charges for this dialogue was to keep that at the center of the discussion. What should we factor in relative to the student and what we're talking about relative to artificial intelligence?
Well, I think trying to mitigate risk and bring in higher level learning processes from the get-go and ethical orientations, responsible AI, when you're designing for students in K-12 and higher ed as well. So a way to do that might be co-designing with developers and teachers and educators and instructor and workforce trainers in the loop of developing these tools. It was mentioned Khanamigo, which is an interesting example, using mastery learning and scaffolding personalized learning. So basically capturing all types of student interactions and student input, student misconceptions, student knowledge levels, and then being able to adjust in an individual one-on-one tutoring type of an approach, which is the strength of some of those tools. And some of it has been borne out by educational research as well about how powerful that is. So always coming back to student-centeredness, to human-centeredness in our design and development of these tools, I think is very important to promote student-centered learning, which is what we all want to take our students forward to be able to tackle future challenges in our world.
Teresa, part of your charge at SUNY is to do just what Brenda's talking about, bring together a bunch of different stakeholders into new centers of learning around areas of import to the country or to education more specifically. Do you have any examples of like how that ecosystem has been built in the right way?
Sure. A perfect example is our newly formed Global Center for AI and Mental Health. Now, this particular center came together around really a conversation that identified a passionate a commitment to identifying and then mitigating mental health challenges, not just here in the U.S., but globally, in particular in the South. So our partner, our conversation partner, was an organization called the Health Innovation Exchange Network, which focuses on South health challenges and bringing together those community partners who have a deep understanding of the context within which the challenges are playing out, who are the stakeholders, what are the barriers to effective care, and then bringing those individuals together with people who understand data, right? So we haven't talked very much about data here today, but and I know data is not our focus necessarily, but people who understand health data and how health data and AI can be a tool here. And then bringing in the mental health professionals, both today's sitting mental health professionals and those that we're training to be tomorrow's leaders, and getting those folks together. How do we understand the interactions? How do we create that sandbox, if you will, that ensures that whatever gets developed is reflective of the priorities and the interests and the challenges of the individuals who are in the mental health service community, but also individuals who are experiencing mental health challenges as well, right? We know that's important. So I think, you know, come back to the question, a perfect example of the creation of these kinds of entities is when we have a 360 view of the challenges that are being faced, of the use case. I think someone mentioned the use case, in this case, mental health, but then has the technologists who are able to tell us, when you think about these questions or challenges in mental health, here's where the technology might be useful as a diagnostic tool, for example. So I think making sure that these folks are brought together on an iterative basis, given the space to be thoughtful and creative and well-informed about the potential of both the technology and the impact of that technology, in this case AI, right, on the potential of the medical professionals to make a sea change difference in the capability in the lives of people suffering with mental health. So that's a perfect example from UAlbany, I think, and it doesn't happen overnight, right? It takes months and months and sometimes years, but in this case, 6 months.
Yes, and the amount of data involved is enormous compared to most of our lives. I remember doing a regression analysis in high school, and if you had 125 pieces of data, that was a lot. It took you a long time to do it. But to analyze human language and use trillions of, you know, conversations that have happened and be able to analyze those in that kind of way, it opens up an amazing capacity, but it's a lot of territory to handle. Personal assistance to help people make fact-based decisions on their daily shopping,
right?
On the pills that they take and talking back to their doctors. So many places where this could be valuable, but the education to make people or help people use it well is what we're going to work with, and we couldn't be working on a more important problem.
Alan, we've seen a lot of the pros be teased out through the course of this season of content. Specifically here, what are some of the pros for students? Like, how will the advent of artificial intelligence in education, in the way that they're taught, the curriculums themselves, how will that benefit students?
How much time do we have now? I would say that there are many ways. It starts in the classroom. It starts with, does a professor encourage or even allow generative AI to be part of their learning process? Now, I've been asked that question, and my answer has been, yes, you may use it. In fact, I encourage them to use it. I know some faculty take quite the opposite view. The reason why I think it's important that they use it is they're going to use it anyway. So we might as well be in front of that one, but then have some caveats. Number one, you are not to submit anything that is not yours. So that means that they should be using this as a tool, an experiment. Use how to make outlines. Understand how to tackle a particular topic. Understand perhaps how to do some research that enables them to go deeper into it, the subjects that they are interested in. And then secondly, make sure whatever they submit, there's some citation. So to me, it is a terrific learning tool that can only help them if used properly. So part of is we have to be able to train them both the good and the bad, make them aware of how it can be used appropriately and how it can be abused if they're not careful. I think if we do that, we're doing them a great service based on the fact that this tool is out there and they're going to use it. We have to help them understand how to drive it.
Teresa, something stood out there.
Teaching our students how to be good prompters, right? So one of the jobs of the future is going to be prompt writing, right? Who is going to be the best at writing prompts that will get them the most efficient and effective ChatGPT response? That's an important job, I think, going forward. If we're thinking about, again, back to societal challenges, we need to get an answer to this kind of question very, very quickly. How do we respond to this extreme weather event? How do we respond to a pandemic, right? You need to be able to write really good prompts. And I think training our students, as you've kind of characterized, to do a good job at that is going to be a really important skill. And our current workforce, right? We can't wait till our students are in those positions of decision making. We need to understand that prompting is a new kind of skill that we're not really prepared for yet.
In prompting, it's an interesting discussion because now we have natural voice interaction with ChatGPT. Last night, for example, I was creating my own personal website just speaking to ChatGPT, who was speaking back to me. It generated the code, the HTML code for my website, and it was checking it and I was guiding it. But all of that was done through natural language. But still the logic of prompting and the understanding what's happening behind the scenes, providing additional context, additional relevance, additional ways to gear, just like you would in a human collaboration when you first met, to provide some context and walk through steps. And so it's the same type of logic and interactions that are happening there. But another point that we haven't spoken about is the ability for these tools to code and to code automatically. So what that does, particularly last week, GPTs were released where you can customize actually your own model and your own interaction. You can feed it your own documents so that not just are you getting all of the knowledge of ChatGPT, but your own pieces of data that you can input. And you can have it generate code for you. So that levels the playing field. Now, any educator can create their own chatbot for their own purposes. And that's a game changer, in my opinion. That opens it up, democratizes a lot of coding and other specialized skills that we don't necessarily need to have anymore.
As we tape this, Alan, I'll note it's NFL season right now, and I'm going to steal on Brenda's phrase there, levels the playing field. Not because it, you know, suggests football, but I've noticed a trend among NFL coaches. They're getting younger and younger as data is becoming more and more intertwined into the business of sports. Is there a parallel there for education? And how do professors, how do folks who are in administration incorporate data, incorporate AI into their careers that's advantageous to them?
Well, there are two things here. I think number one, is there parallels? Yes, the parallels are there for coaching, for learning, for teaching. There are so many really good use cases out there. What I see, though, back to your original question, the other part, is at least the NFL, because maybe there's a profit motive, but I don't see, except maybe your institution and some of your places of work, that much leadership happening yet. So in other words, the need is there, but we need leadership at the highest levels to say, we need to do a better job of integrating this. This technology is that important. We have to have a bit more thinking about this and more deliberateness in what we do, in all the things that we do in terms of teaching, learning, and research.
Brenda?
That sports analogy is interesting because there's the capability now for what we call multimodal learning analytics. We use this in a research project I did with first responder teams in live simulation training contexts, where we had wearable devices and the building itself was instrumented, and we were able to do to track kind of their movements, and we staged an active shooter situation in one of our buildings on campus, and we were able to do kind of a instant replay of where first responder teams were working together, how and time response times and other fine-grained analytics, and show it to them immediately following. It's like an instant replay in football, but here we are elevating their training and their feedback in the live simulation training debrief. So there's an example of utilizing some of those insights for learning and training.
Fascinating. Teresa?
So believe it or not, a lot of higher education research is about contract management. Some of us might not be surprised to hear that, right? So when we receive a grant, let's say from the National Science Foundation or the NIH, there are many contractual issues that need to be considered. And so we're on a project right now to look at how can we use AI to do the contract reviews that are necessary so we can accelerate the consideration of those contracts. So that's kind of a standard application that AI is being used for, both in higher ed and beyond, right? So how do we think about these basic administrative processes that slow down access to and use of research dollars that have been awarded to the university? And so we're trying to figure out on our university, how can we use, you know, we have the AI and the academic side, but we certainly are trying to look as well on how can we kind of change the way the university operates through the use of AI as part of an administrative tool. And we're seeing some really great opportunities here, some really great potential. And I think that'll help accelerate our research results as well. If we can get the money in more quickly, we can get it spent, we can get our results, and we can translate it to practice.
Yeah, I remember letting people know how old I am. Kennedy's inaugural address. And at the time, talking about getting the country moving again, but he did say that a lot of public policy things need careful decisions and analysis. About the time the moonshots were going on, and there was a great respect for science and using data and information. We've lost a lot of that respect in the meantime. So I'm very happy when I hear football coming forward to say, hey, there's some data even in those decisions that can be made. We need a resurgence of respect for data, what it can do, also what it can't do, right. But to have an objective analysis of data as an objective way to make many decisions
right. That
we don't now, because we've got the data. We've got the analytic power. Let's learn how to use it.
Right. And a lot of that isn't actually AI, right? It's respect for data and basic capability, right? So I spend not a lot of time, but a reasonable amount of time saying that is a really interesting problem. And I think there's a really interesting potential here for us to use data to explore that. But it's not artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. It's data analytics. Right. It's statistical analysis. Right. So that needs to be, we need to, I think, continue to focus on those skills. A lot of our, you know, the sports, right? We all know about how data is being used in sports and lots of other places. But if you will, I think it's an on-ramp to the more sophisticated uses of the technologies of the artificial intelligence. But our students need to understand data and the potential of data and where and when to use it to solve and inform problems.
I think that's where critical thinking comes in. Yeah. We've talked about this idea of what is critical thinking, to be able to look at a product that may have come out of AI and say, is this real or not? And be able to dissect that, not in a negative way, or just in an objective way, I think that really helps with the learning process. And that's a good use of technology, but it does tie back to the data for sure.
Brenda?
I think where generative AI comes into play is that we've never before been able to analyze this volume of data this fast and in real time, almost near real time, some. And so that is what really changes the game. So now all of this data is useful, and we need to figure out how to make sense of it in meaningful ways. But the capacity to do that in real time, even in a classroom setting, to be able to look at fine-grained behaviors we've never been able to really analyze in real time and potentially maybe even provide back to the student for self-monitoring or and certainly to the teacher. And so it opens up all types of possibilities, if you will, for smart classrooms, smart experiences, public type experiences, training settings, where this data and this real-time processing of data to inform our own behaviors and our own learning is just amazing, in its possibilities.
Yeah. I really like everything that's been said, but I picked out the phrase sense-making, right? So how to make sense of what we're hearing. So I think the sense-making process is a key part of what I think we need to train our students, to educate our students to do. What does that sense-making process look like? And then I think, again, back to this idea of, so for example, if we are in an emergency operations center and we're providing all kinds of data to our emergency response professionals, and now some of that data is coming in through AI, it's social media, it's all pulling all the data sources and making recommendations. How does that change the decision-making process of the individuals who are charged with decision-making, and now they have this new source, right? Their professional identity has been their intuition. I know what's going to happen with this storm. I know that river. Well, now we have new data that could tell us the storm is not going to operate like other storms. So how will we understand the impact of the access to this data or these recommendations on the decision-making process itself? And I think that's a really interesting aspect of this, whether it's a student making a decision about how to behave, or, you know, some of our most senior professionals. How does access to this information change the way they interact with data and make decisions?
Jerry, at the top of the program, I asked you to be Mr. Doom and Gloom. So I've saved this other side of the coin for you at the close of this program. And my question is rooted in the word inspiration. You know, Brenda, before we went on the air, used this phrase tectonic shift to talk about where we are in artificial intelligence and public education right now. And one challenge I don't think that we've discussed is, while all of these amazing conversations are happening, while you as public educators are navigating the future use of artificial intelligence in our education systems, how do you still walk that fine tectonic line where you are inspiring students?
Would you ask an easier question? I think it's very critical, and it bumps you up, I think, against a very controversial set of things, because many people have very conflicting views as to how information ought to be used. And particularly if you're restructuring how the society works, what jobs are there, what institutions get what responsibility to do stuff, you walk into a word called politics at some point, and that's a very controversial set of things. I think it's quite exciting now, however, to look back on the time we heard the phrase, trust your gut, and the conflicting phrase, trust the data. And now we're in a world where, though that conflict is much more useful and powerful and dangerous and positive than it's ever been before, for us to learn how to help our students and our institutions to create a better balance between using data when it's available, but then using human interactions to decide what do we do when the data doesn't tell us everything. I think that conflict in running families, in running countries, in running individual lives is being played out here. And I'm looking forward to the future because it's a very important future. It's quite different than we've had before. Like we started, this could be transformational. Our kids are going to have to live with it as well. But tomorrow, we need to work on this.
Great conversation on AI technologies and public education with Jerry Meckling, Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Brenda Bannon, she's professor in the College of Education and Human Development at George Mason University. Teresa Pardo, Assistant VP of Research and Economic Development at the University at Albany State University of New York, SUNY. And my co-host, it's been a pleasure co-hosting this series with you, Alan Shark, Associate Professor, Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thanks all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, our audience, for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this 8-episode season on AI in the public sector as much as I have. If you're watching this program on demand and you missed any of the first 7 episodes, you can watch them all at govexec.com/events. For GovExec TV, I'm George Jackson. Have a great day.